2010, 2011, 2012, there were probably like 25 hearings on data privacy on Facebook and Experian and, you know, data breaches and all that kind of stuff. And nothing happened. Nothing happened at all because the data giants have very effective lobbyists.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I spoke recently with Sean Dakin, a digital marketing strategist who consults through Dakin Associates, primarily for Moms Clean Air Force, a project of the Environmental Defense Fund that fights against air pollution and causes of climate change. He also teaches digital marketing. He works, in addition, as an advocate in data privacy as the co-founder of Privacy Camp and was the founder and CEO of the National Political Do Not Contact Registry. He used to work in product and marketing strategy for a number of big companies before that. So Sean teaches, studies, and practices digital marketing and digital politics. And we had a good conversation about his path and about his current work. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Sean Dakin of Dakin & Associates and Moms Clean Air Force.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is G-R-A-P-H-I-C-A-C-Y.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Sean. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. Thanks again for having me on the podcast. I love the podcast. And so I'm Sean Dakin, and I run a consulting firm called Dakin Associates. But many people may have kind of come into contact with me and what I've done in kind of 2007-2008 timeframe, where I started the National Political Do Not Call registry and was really fighting to get politicians to stop robocalling people and invading their privacy, and was able to testify for Senator Feinstein. And she has been a big proponent of trying to defeat political robocalls herself. And then I started something called Privacy Camp, working on data privacy. And then in the last 6-7 years, I've really focused a lot on the digital communication space, working for Moms Clean Air Force as their digital lead. So
that's an interesting place to find yourself. Mm-hmm. How did you first get into this intersection of technology and politics? Because you have an MBA background, right?
Exactly. I'm definitely coming out of the business world, but always was very interested in politics. I'm a poli-sci major, went to Colby College, interned for Senator Leahy from Vermont, who's still there, and then got my MBA and worked at some big companies, but in the technology space. So it was kind of a technology product manager doing e-commerce. I was part of the first e-commerce group at FedEx, where we put tracking on the internet. So I'm sure most of your listeners have tracked a package. And so I was part of the team that put that initial tracking up on the internet and creating labels, shipping labels on the internet. And so really have always been very interested in technology. And then in the 2007 timeframe, I kind of left my business world. I was working at the Motley Fool at the time, which is a website for finance, and started my consulting firm, but also started the National Political Do Not Contact Registry to kind of figure out how to stop these political robocalls, because I just thought that they were not leading to anything that was very positive for anybody, for politicians, for voters, and wanted to see whether I could have kind of a unique space there. And I did. You know, there's nobody else was working on it, and I understood technology more than a lot of other people did, as well as communications. So that was a lot of fun.
Didn't you have a little stint with the Kerry campaign in the fundraising world?
Yeah. So I was at Fannie Mae at the time, and I decided to take a leave of absence and go work at the DNC. I had a friend who was in the finance department there, and worked on large donor fundraising for a short period of time, which was amazing, kind of sitting in the DNC and calling and getting people to go to surrogate events and fundraising for any purpose that they needed me to do that. I actually sat next to Don Beyer, who's now my congressman. At the time, I think he had just stopped being lieutenant governor of Virginia. So he and I were kind of sitting next to each other, dialing for dollars, as it were.
What did you learn from that experience?
I learned a lot personally, just to, you know, get over any kind of fears of just punching the phone and asking people for money. And I learned if you don't ask people for money, you're not going to get money.
So, I mean, I think that's one of the things that fundraisers learn is, and politicians know, is that the money doesn't necessarily just come to them. It gets extracted from people, right? It's an ask.
It's totally, yeah. It's definitely an ask. And definitely, you know, this was back, I think Howard Dean had definitely opened up the small donor fundraising spigot a little bit. But at this point, we were full into the general election cycle. And I definitely learned that you're never going to get the money unless you call people, unless you ask people. And that was a huge learning for me for the rest of my life, right? I mean, it's just not going to happen unless you pick up the phone.
Did you call any notable people?
The people I called that were really notable, you know, I never got them on the phone. I got their assistants and stuff like that. But so there wasn't much to say other than, yes, she or he will be at the event or not.
I haven't spent really any time thinking about robocalls, except to sort of be moderately annoyed when local politicians are using them sort of in city council races that hit my DC phone. But it does seem to me that I'm much more annoyed by a commercial call, and that there's something at least redeeming about a politician reaching out around an election to try to raise awareness about his or her campaign, but it is still pretty annoying. What set you off about robocalls?
Kind of the origin story was back working for Kerry Edwards, the final week, you know, of the campaign, they shut down the DNC and they sent everybody, in my case, I went to Cleveland, Ohio, and we did everything we could, including making phone calls. And so I wasn't doing robocalls, but I was, you know, I was doing phone banking, right? And in those days, we actually had a phone bank, right? We actually sat in front of phones and dialed phones. Everybody I actually got on the phone was just like, who you with? You're with Kerry? I'm gonna vote for Bush.
Because you called me.
Because I'm so sick of these phone calls and you're invading my privacy. And so, of course, I kept doing it because we were going to win and I had to do everything possible to win. But after that, I really kind of thought about it and I started looking at the data. There's not a lot of data out there that shows that that even person-to-person phone calls work, and definitely robocalls do not really work, right? So there's been a lot of work done out of Yale and other places where they look at the efficacy of voter contact systems, and robocalls are like the bottom of the list, right? I totally understand, like, I'm in Virginia and I don't get that many, but if you live in a battleground state and you're about a month out from a general election, you're getting, you know, 10 to 15 calls a day for weeks on end. And that's really annoying. And also kind of, it can be a pain. There were definitely stories back in those days where people were on like healthcare systems, right, where they had to get phone calls to come in. And they would get these robocalls on the line that was dedicated to send data back to the hospital for that particular patient. And that would stop that data from going back to the hospital. So there were instances of that. But mostly it's just kind of an invasion of privacy. And it's another thing that politicians do and don't really ask for permission. That's the bottom line. Like, they wrote the Do Not Call list law and they specifically exempted themselves. And so many voters are just like, yeah, of course. Of course politicians exempted themselves from the law.
It seems like it's on the spectrum with unwanted texts, unwanted emails. There's a lot of ways that we get contacted that we don't want to be by people we haven't asked for, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so where I bring a little bit of understanding is that, so from the business world, one of the first things I learned was permission marketing, right? So Seth Godin is a big marketer in the business world. And he talks about if you can get people to give you their permission to contact them, right? Opt in, that's a relationship you want to develop. But if you're spamming people, it's going to be very difficult to develop any kind of long-term relationship. And so I brought that sensibility to this project. Now, I learned a lot about politics, i.e. that politicians don't care because politicians are going from cycle to cycle. And so they can afford to kind of burn bridges because they know that they'll stop. And the day after the election, the robocalls stop and all this other stuff stops. And voters have very short memories. And then it starts 2 years later or 4 years later or whatever the case may be. And they just keep moving on.
Who was on the side of robocalls being a good idea?
Consultants.
Consultants that sold robocalling.
Consultants that sold robocalling, right?
And was there anybody else?
Very few. So when I testified at the U.S. Senate, I sat next to Roy Cooper, who was at that point the Attorney General of North Carolina, who's now the governor of North Carolina, and he was on my side. But next to me was a guy, I forget his name, but he was a First Amendment, Citizens United, Supreme Court lawyer guy. It was all about the First Amendment and freedom of speech and robocalls being a form of political speech that you could not regulate. That was his take. But in the political world, consultants do a lot of things that make money. And as you probably well know, it's a little bit better, but 10 years ago, a consultant could say, well, I did this in the last election and we won, so let's do it now because we won. But there was no actual data to show that they work or not.
And you would think that because they cost money, that eventually metrics would drive them out of the system if they're not valuable.
Yeah. So the political system is such that there's not a lot of learning between cycles, and consultants are incented to spend all the money possible. And when you're in the last 2 to 3 weeks of a campaign, you have no time to do direct mail. It's all been done. Maybe the TV ads have been sold. And so really, you have email and robocalls that are left that are very flexible, and you can press a button and turn them on without a lot of capacity issues. So consultants, the last thing they want to do is at the end of an election say that we didn't spend the money that we had, right? And so this is just one of many tools that they have, but particularly in the end of an election cycle that they do is robocalls.
So what was the result regulation-wise of your work in this area?
Nothing, right? So I was doing kind of the Lord's work, but the bottom line is that there were a lot of politicians who were like, yeah, this is a great idea, but they're very, very difficult for politicians to regulate themselves, right? If they have something that they've given themselves an out to, it's going to require something absolutely catastrophic for them to turn that around. So
there's nothing that stops them from robocalling currently, but you created a list, right? Is that something for voluntary?
So I created a list. And so, yes. So what I was able to do is I was able to get a number of politicians to kind of sign on to pledge not to robocall. And if they wanted my list, they could get the list essentially for free and agree not to call people who were on the list. The ultimate thing I wanted them to do is essentially not make any calls at all, right? So to pledge not to call. The second thing was, well, pledge not to call people who are on the list that I created. And I ended up getting like 600,000 people on the list.
And how many people obeyed that
I think we ended up having maybe 15 candidates from state offices to a couple of congressional candidates. One who's still around, Congresswoman Fox from North Carolina, who's a deep red Republican, which was really interesting that she was really in on this.
So still a revolution waiting to happen here.
Yeah, I just don't. And so fast forward to today, there's lots of robocalls that are happening, mostly on, people have mobile phones. And people have just kind of stopped answering the phone. I mean, I don't know about you, but really people have stopped answering the phone, or they have robocall blockers, or they just don't pick up and they let it to go to voicemail and it's transcribed and they see it's a robocall. So, but it's still ringing, right? So to the extent that it annoys people, waking up babies, waking up you, interrupting your meetings, interrupting your life without your permission. That's the thing. It's like you've never given these politicians your permission.
So tell me what other work you've done in the privacy arena and how that's gone.
Right. So out of that, I then you know, people were like, well, you're working on robocalls, but, you know, like, you're also, you know, what does this really mean, right? And I said, oh, well, this means privacy, right? This is really, you're talking about privacy. And so I started to really get to know a lot of the people who at that time and still are kind of at the forefront of the world of data and privacy.
Can you kind of lay out that?
Sure.
Like, who are those people
and
groups?
So out in San Francisco, there's EFF, which many people may know of.
Electronic Frontier Foundation or something?
Electronic Frontier Foundation. And then in this town, the Center for American Progress had an interest, not all that they did. But the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT, has a huge interest in data privacy and consumer privacy. And then EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, along with Access Now and a couple of other organizations. And so their focus is mostly on kind of consumer and business privacy and also government data, use of databases and the NSA and the FBI and surveillance and things like that, but also Facebook and Google and all those areas. And so coming out of that and meeting all of these people, it was also the time where the unconference movement was taking off, at least in the Washington, D.C. area, right? It was Roots Camp and eDemocracy Camp, and they were blossoming. And I said, well, let's start a privacy camp. And I started to get to know people like Alan Rosenblatt, and he was at CAP at the time. And I said, hey, you know, I need a location to do this. CDT has signed on, Center for Democracy and Technology, to sponsor as Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC. But we need a facility to do this. And Alan was very kind to work the system at CAP to get us to have the location to be at CAP.
And Alan's a former guest on the show.
Yes. Yes. He's an amazing man.
What's your sort of general philosophy in the privacy area, particularly with respect to politics?
We're kind of at a reckoning, right? So there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but there's a reckoning from a voter perspective, right? And, you know, how do we maintain voter records and, you know, how do we contact voters and give them permission? There's definitely has to be some thinking there. There is no, as I mentioned, you know, politicians, the last thing that they want to do is pass any law, let alone pass a law that restricts what they want to do. So I don't see a lot going on there.
Well, what would you like to see happen?
Again, I would like to see what the European Union is doing with the GDPR, right, which is the General Data Protection Rights or something like that. I forget exactly. But they are really at the forefront of essentially giving consumers control over their data. They have the right to be forgotten. You have to show what cookies are being used and why they're being used. And if people want their data removed, consumers have the right to do that.
And you can also get your data, right? You can download your data.
You can download your data. You can do that here, too. I mean, if you want all your Google data or your Facebook data, you can do that here.
I shudder to think what mine is.
Exactly. I did it maybe 10 years ago, but I haven't done it since. But I think that's where we're moving, right? Because the globalized world that we live in, so much of what Google and Facebook and the rest of the gang do are in the EU. And the EU is essentially saying, if you want to play here, you have to play by our rules. And the EU has a backbone and they have teeth, and they are getting these big tech giants to do something about this. And so I think eventually Facebook, Google, the rest of the gang will say, they'll cry uncle and they'll say, okay, you know, we want a global standard here.
We'll do the same thing we're doing in Europe.
We're doing the same thing because it just makes sense, right? It just totally makes sense. And we want to get Congress off our back, because what I've noticed since I got really involved, like at the beginning of the Obama administration, well, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012, there were probably like 25 hearings on data privacy on Facebook and Experian and, you know, data breaches and all that kind of stuff. And nothing happened. Nothing happened at all, because the data giants have very effective lobbyists.
So you've made yourself an expert on social media and how to influence people in that way.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned? What's changed? What's And what do you teach people now?
Sure. So I may have mentioned, but I teach digital marketing at George Mason University as an adjunct every semester. And I teach digital marketing and social media marketing. But I got into this out of kind of necessity, being the mother of invention. So when I started the National Political Do Not Contact Registry, Twitter had just started and Facebook had just started. And I didn't have much money at all. I was doing this totally self-funded. And so I had to really figure out how to use the tools available out there in order to kind of make, get a lot of earned media, get a lot of free media attention. And I learned very quickly kind of how to identify kind of where robocalls were happening from what people were saying on Twitter, right? It was amazing. Like I was listening, paying attention to, monitoring what people were saying on Twitter, and I could find out almost in real time when John McCain was robocalling.
Because you would get complaints, basically.
I would see people complaining about getting robocalls, and it was all on Twitter. And of course, Twitter is totally in public, and nobody else was really doing that. And so I became very good at identifying that, contacting those people, and then even getting the audio to the robocall, and then using my contacts in the media to drive stories.
Well, did you use any particular technology to search Twitter or just base Twitter?
I think I was using Hootsuite at the time and, Google Alerts. And again, I didn't have a lot of money to spend. But what I learned is that in real time, I could drive the story. And so there were a number of occasions where the lead story in Politico or something was about what John McCain was robocalling in Ohio. And that was coming directly out of, the work that I was doing. And
were you publishing it and they were picking it up, or were you sending it to them?
I was sending it to them. So by kind of the general election, by the time it had started, I had a number of really good contacts within, even today, Sam Stein, Ben Smith, who now runs BuzzFeed, who was at Politico at the time. They were on my, essentially distribution list. And I would say...
So do you have a newsletter that you were sending out, or was it just an email?
It was an email. Huh? It was a phone call. I would text. I mean, I would text Ben Smith and I would say, hey, Ben, I have a robocall John McCain made. He's accusing Obama of being a terrorist, right? Bill Ayers and all that whole thing that went on. I have the audio for this. And
that was gold for them.
That was gold, right? I mean, that was just boom.
It was supposed to be running under the radar.
Yeah. It was totally. And that was really the first time that was so interesting, because the robocalls before then were kind of like, they were in the ether, right? You kind of heard that they were happening, but you never really had the audio file, right?
Does anyone run them so that they don't go to answering machines to avoid that?
I think technically you can do that now. Yeah. But in the old days, they would go definitely to the answer phone. Mm-hmm. It was a way to get in real time. And I would say, hey, Ben, I mean, this would be like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd say, hey, Ben, I have this. It's yours for the next hour. And he would either say, awesome, or he'd say, sorry, I'm too busy. And then I would go to Sam Stein and say, Sam, this is for you. I don't know where he was at the time, Talking Points Memo. Anyway, he's moved.
Did you also share... Democratic.
Yeah. So I was at that point in time, my nonprofit, my registry was nonpartisan, bipartisan. And so I would find stuff that Obama was doing, that anybody else was doing, and get that out as well. And in fact, I had an op-ed published in the Washington Post where I, essentially skewered the Obama campaign, because they were doing some really interesting things around finding people's like voter registration databases and displaying that online and essentially being able to find out how your neighbor voted, but also find out their age and
whether they voted, probably not how they voted.
Right. So whether they voted, but they were displaying.
They were trying to get. There's probably part of their turnout up.
Yes, and they were displaying though items that they didn't need to display, like age and full phone number.
I think there were some tests showing that would induce people to vote.
Yeah, there were definitely tests. So that was, there were definitely tests.
It's pretty controversial.
Yeah, it was definitely controversial. But it's kind of normal voter. My argument was, this is an awesome tool. You are invading people's privacy, but there are a lot of data elements that you're showing people. This was on like mybarackobama.com, that you don't need to to share with people. Like, they don't need to know my age. They don't need to know the age of the person that they're calling. These were tools that were allowing like peer-to-peer technology or telephones to happen. So anyway, I had an op-ed published in the Washington Post about calling for, you know, data privacy and no more robocalls. And I had the Obama press shop calling me and trying to get me to shut it down. So that was a funny period.
So is Dakin and Associates, are there any associates or is that you?
Dakin Associates. So I have people that I use for when I need people to run, you know, my social media ad campaigns, people who are really, really, really good at targeting on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I have people who are really good at SEO. I have, you know, if I need, you know.
But these are contractors.
Yeah, these are contractors. Yeah, these are contractors.
And so who are clients for you?
Yeah, so my main client is in the environmental space. So it's the Environmental Defense Fund and Moms Clean Air Force. That keeps me busy. I'd say that is, you know, pretty much a full-time gig. And then I do some paid but mostly pro bono work in the gun control movement. And then last year I did a bunch of work for a consortium of environmental groups around the GCAS Summit in San Francisco, the Global Climate Action Summit, where, you know, I did all the social media for that particular campaign for about 3 months. But on a day-to-day basis, it's really focused on Moms Clean Air Force. And
so talk about that a little bit. Who are they and what are they up to and how are you helping them?
So Moms Clean Air Force is a group that's focused on women, on moms, on the power of moms. We've been around for about 8 years. It's primarily about calling for legislative action on climate change and using the power of the moms and women's voices, of course, and also focused on the health aspect, right? Because the challenge was we'd just seen the failure of Marky Waxman, the carbon tax bill. The entire environmental movement was despondent. The Tea Party was in power. And so there was a lot of rethinking about, okay, how do we get a grassroots movement, right? It can't be just all inside baseball and lobbying and getting the right chairman and chairwoman on board. And so out of that was born Moms Clean Air Force from the Environmental Defense Fund. And so we're now, I think, 1.2 million members, which has been spectacular on a social media perspective. Facebook.
And when you're talking about members, does a member mean they're making some kind of contribution or they're signed up on your list?
So they are people that we can email to and
ask part of your permission marketing group.
Yes, they're part of our permission marketing group. The people that we ask to take action, essentially, you know, a portion of those people donate just like any other.
Are they a subset of the EDF list in general or is there just overlap? How does that?
I don't know the full overlap, but they're two separate databases. And that was started at the very beginning. They wanted them to be two separate databases because from the very beginning, it was supposed to be, and still is primarily a very different audience than EDF had dealt with, right? And so it's a totally separate database, different messaging, different goals. But the bottom line is it focuses primarily on the health impacts of climate change, environmental pollution, rather than, you know, in the past, it was very much like, you know, the glaciers are melting and the polar bears are disappearing and all really incredibly important things. But there was an understanding that, you know, kind of the average American couldn't necessarily identify with the polar bear.
So this is trying to bring it home to people's actual daily lives, how it's affecting
exactly
them.
And from a health perspective, right? So asthma and, you know, mercury poison coming out of coal plants going into fish and, you know, pregnant women not being able to eat fish because of mercury in the fish. Bringing it home and making it real so people can actually identify with what's going on.
So there's probably no better way to learn about what works and what doesn't work than having a fairly big list like that and trying things, right?
Exactly.
So what has worked and what has not worked?
It's a combination of constantly iterating and testing messaging. And what I love about digital in general, as you well know, is that, you know, you can come up with a hypothesis in the morning and test it in the afternoon. In general, we're constantly kind of testing between hope and fear, optimism and destruction.
And what tends to work.
And also humor, right? You know, particularly on social media. Unfortunately, kind of the anti-Trump I would say unfortunately, but that's what really gets people going, right? So for this week, I actually posted an older story on our Facebook page about how Trump had shut down kind of the Environmental Justice Office within the EPA. And he did that in 2017. But just posting that got huge engagement, even though we made it very clear that this was a story from 2017. We're really focused right now on trying to stop Andrew Wheeler for becoming the official EPA, head of the EPA. So we're, from a campaign perspective, we're on every channel. We have our field staff. We're on the Hill, on every social channel, email, everywhere.
What, enumerate those social channels if they're
heavy. Yeah. So our main social channels are Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, mm-hmm. right? We're also on LinkedIn. We were on Google Plus. Google Plus is being shut down if it hasn't already been shut down. Then, of course, YouTube and Flickr and places like that. But from a day-to-day communication perspective, those are the three channels. And
do you run an email list also?
Oh, yeah. We have an email list. Yeah. And so I always tell people, you know, if we really need to drive action today, it's email, right? Email is always king or queen or whatever you want to call it. There's nothing like a permission-based email action.
Well, it seems like it's pretty hard. Like, if you post something on Twitter, what are the odds that someone's going to actually see your posting among all of the things they're following?
Yeah. Slim. Yeah. So Twitter for us is very much a kind of influencer communications channel where we are mentioning elected officials, mentioning thought leaders, mentioning journalists. We are doing live tweeting from hearings and events and things like that. We're posting videos, live streaming videos as we interview staffers in the halls of Congress or something like that. So it varies specifically. We don't, you know, like most people, you know, Twitter is not a place for like, hey, click here to contact your senator. We do that as well, but it's very much of a place to kind of be out there in the open. On Facebook, we do more of the, hey, click here to take action, and we can sponsor that. We can drive action there. We can measure the results and the cost per action and stuff like that, which is more it's more of a community-based area. And then we're seeing a lot of uptick on Instagram, like many people. I mean, Instagram is a very friendly, beautiful place. We're trying stories. We're trying Instagram TV, all that stuff. And, you know, we do very well. And so we use – I don't know how familiar you are with CrowdTangle, right? So CrowdTangle is an amazing tool that allows us to monitor kind of what's working and what's not working, compare it to benchmarks and what competition is doing. Particularly in the Facebook area, we are almost always, you know, in the top five of the kind of the most engaged Facebook pages in the world from in the environmental movement. Let's just say we have a much smaller team than many of the people that were, you know.
Who else would be in the top five in that?
Oh, so Sierra Club, 350.org, NRDC, Greenpeace.
Big giant environmental groups.
Giant, you know, Environmental Defense Fund, all those places. And so what we've been able to do with social media.
So when you're talking about this, are you talking about the moms group or are you talking about the EDF?
Talking about moms specifically, yeah. So EDF is also part of that. But we really have been able to essentially punch way above our weight and become very visible. I mean, social media has been a place for us to become very visible. And so that when elected officials are kind of like, who is Moms Clean Air Force? They're seeing our posts, they're, you know, viewing our posts, they're seeing pictures of our moms in their state offices, in their Washington, D.C. offices. We're seeing engagement that equals, you know, organizations that have many millions more members on a global scale with social teams that are 10x our size.
What is the size and budget of the social media approximately for what you're doing? Like, what are you bringing to this?
We have both kind of the talent, both internal and external. I don't know what the full budget is.
How many people are we talking
about? Oh, we're talking two full-time people. We also were one of some of the first people to understand that you can't just rely on organic social. You have to pay to play. And so we have some very sophisticated testing.
Obviously, you're teaching a class in this.
Yeah.
Or you have been teaching this class repeatedly.
Yeah.
What are the big lessons? Like, what if you have a few minutes to sit down with someone who's doing something similar
sure.
for another group and trying to do as well, mm-hmm. what should they be doing?
So first, you have to understand your goals, right? Your goals and objectives and what you're trying to do. And so, you know, once you understand that, then you can understand kind of what channels you got to go for. Because the worst thing is that people come to me and say, hey, we need a Facebook strategy. And of course, my first question to them is, well, you know, what's our goal? Like, who's your audience? If you're not looking for a particular audience in specific, Facebook may not be the place to play, right? So once you figured out your goals and objectives and what you're trying to do, then you figure out what channels you want to play on.
So what's the big goal for the moms group?
So the big goal for the moms group is awareness, you know, essentially to get our brand in front of as many people as possible on a daily basis, create a community so that when we do ask them to take action, we're top of mind, right?
So you're end of the day wanting to have credibility with legislators?
Exactly.
So that they know that there's heft behind these messages.
Yeah. And for our members to say, okay, so when they get that email, it says, call your congressman or woman. They're like, oh yeah, you know, I've totally, like, I've been interacting with Moms Clean Air Force on social channels. They're totally on top of it. I know what they're working on. And I'm much more likely to open that email and I'm much more likely to take that action. And then, of course, at the end of the chain, if we ask for a donation, they're much more likely to give us a donation.
Aside from CrowdTangle, what other technologies are integral to what you do?
So we use Hootsuite to manage all of our social channels to the extent that we need to kind of see what's going on and schedule things in advance. So that's kind of the main tool. We also use Buffer.
What's Buffer?
Buffer is like Hootsuite. So it's you can manage multiple channels in one interface mm-hmm. across social channels. Besides that, you know, all the tools now have very sophisticated analytics, right? So Facebook has its own analytics. Facebook has its own scheduling. Twitter, same thing. So we use a combination of all that, of all those things.
Some people are, as you've referenced, making videos, doing live streaming of video
yep.
versus doing graphics, audio. What gets attention and provides the best bang for your buck, say an investment in that content creation?
I'd say video is definitely at the top of the stream, and live streaming. So we are becoming better and better at going into offices, going into events, and having our field staff live stream those events.
And when you do that, what's the range? Are you getting 6 people watching it? Are you getting 100,000 people watching it? What's the range?
Yeah, so we get anywhere, you know, between a couple hundred people watching it to a couple thousand people watching it. But then, of course, the brilliance is that you can then turn that into many different things, right? So you can download that. You can put it up on YouTube. You can create a blog post out of it. You can put it up on Twitter. You can, you know, do a transcript out of it. So there's a lot of reusing of content and making sure that you're kind of squeezing every last bit out of that mechanism. Of course, if you have an interview with an elected official, you know, making sure that the staff sees it, has the URL, that we tag them, that we thank them, because we're just constantly developing relationships so that when we do ask them to take a vote, they take the vote with the way we want it.
Through the lens of this expertise in digital marketing, what was your view on the 2016 presidential election? What did you see going on there?
I think there was a lot of interesting work done on, you know, on both sides. I've been very skeptical. There was a lot of the narrative coming out of the election was that, you know, Trump was did amazing stuff and they just did all this incredible Facebook work and Facebook was into, you know, embedded in the campaign and they blew Hillary out of the water. And I just was like, I don't really know whether that was true or not. And I've really been paying attention to, like, there was this narrative that went out that said that, you know, they were doing, you know, 300,000 variants of Facebook ads. And then, you know, if you really kind of, if you're in that world and you understand what's going on, you can't do 300,000 versions of a single ad. Mathematically, you're testing, you know, images, you're testing font sizes, you're testing colors, you're testing offers and incentives and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you're not doing 300,000 different ones of those things, right? So I think that they were by kind of necessity doing some really interesting things on social and digital, but so was Hillary as well. At the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that Trump was and continues to be the person that gets all the oxygen in the room, i.e., anytime he had a live stream, anytime he was up on CNN, anytime he tweeted about anything, it became news. It becomes news. He tweets this morning and it becomes a headline on the news. And whereas, Hillary and normal politicians, they can't do that. They don't do that. It's all very scripted and it's very planned and it's very hard to compete with that. Plus, of course, you had all of the Russian stuff going on, which, again, I don't know how impactful it was, but it was definitely impactful. And people were influenced by all of these fake accounts that were sowing division in particular groups of people. I hope that we can get beyond that and people are smarter next year, but I don't have much hope.
Is it too early to distinguish among the Democrats running in terms of this? Is this something you pay close attention to?
I'm paying somewhat attention to, and I definitely, from a digital perspective, been very impressed with Kamala Harris and her team. I don't know them personally, but I've been paying attention to kind of the ads that they've been doing and the text messaging and their SEO and their online ads and stuff like that. Like, so for example, the day she announced, when I Googled her name, the very first thing that came up on the Google as a Google ad was an Act Blue donation link to her, right? And I was like, "That's pretty smart. You know, that's smart marketing." Everybody else, I don't know who else is really doing amazing. I think they all have. There's so much talent on the Dem side. What I'm looking for is people to really start innovating, right? Because we're always fighting kind of the last election cycle. And there'll be something that somebody does that's going to be so cool and new that nobody's thought of. And that's really where we're going to see the breakout.
Well, one interesting development is that Trump hired his digital marketing guru as a campaign manager.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's – I think that's a new one.
That's on that side, totally new. And I think we're definitely seeing on our side then a realization that kind of the old TV guys and gals kind of running everything and, you know, TV being the center of the action. I think people definitely moving beyond that. We're way too early to see how that actually happens in the Democratic side. With Trump and his guy, I think it's going to be interesting. But the bottom line is, in Trump world, Trump is the campaign manager, right? So to the extent that he has a named campaign manager, I don't think it really means the same as it does in the Democratic side.
What else should I be asking you about your work that I failed to so far?
I mean, the person we haven't really talked about is AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I've just been, you know, just blown away on a daily basis with her ability to like Trump, drive the narrative, and she has just, you know, I'm
learning. Is that a good thing?
I think so. Yeah, I
mean,
to the extent that her narrative is good for us, and I'm looking for anybody who can get people's attention talking about issues that I care about and the progressives care about. And she happens to be the person who's doing that. And I just think she's doing it in such an amazing way. I mean, every day I'm learning about what she's doing. And, you know, to the extent that I'm asking my clients, you know, like, if we can get her to, like, mention us, you know, that would be amazing. If we could get her at one of our events, that would be amazing, right? Because the reach that she has is extraordinary. I think I just read an article this morning, and I think the only person who has more followers on Twitter is like Nancy Pelosi or something.
On our side.
But in terms of reach and voice, she's way ahead of everybody.
So does this drive our politics, though, towards the attentions, the show horses rather than the workhorses? I'm not sure that that's what she is at this stage, but she's certainly not the most senior, most
right.
Well-known, most
she's not
steeped
waiting.
In policy.
She's not waiting at the end of the line to kind of wait her turn.
No, this is the same thing that happened in a different way in the 50s and 60s when you had people mad that John Kennedy was stepping out of line, you know, and rising quicker. But it's, you know, it's a late 20s person with suddenly a giant national following. I wonder about that a little bit, even though I see her as a very appealing person.
I've wondered about it, and yet every week I'm like, well, you know, she's going to learn, and she, you know, somebody's going to put her in her place, or you know, whatever. You're kind of like the old grizzled Washington hand, you know, cynical. And every day she blows me away with her like her level of like maturity.
There's a certain amount of fearlessness that that is rare, of course. You know, she came to this job taking on the fourth ranking Democrat and beating him.
Yeah.
So why should she be afraid of anything? But
I totally agree. Kind of like Trump is like, hey, I did all this stuff and I won and nobody else was won.
So what would you advise a politician who has strong convictions, but those convictions aren't attention getting necessarily? They're not out of the mainstream. How does such a person find attention for their work?
It's really hard. I mean, the bottom line is they can't be somebody that they're not, right? So they have to find out, you know, what is their voice and how they want to speak. And in fact, social media and social channels may not be what they want to do. They want to be kind of a traditional politician where they give speeches and they write press releases and they go on the floor of the House or whatever it is. And they do town hall meetings and they do it kind of what most people do, right? That's how it's done. But I would encourage people to, you know, to learn from AOC, as we now call her, right? She's kind of, it's like Oprah and Hillary and AOC. Everybody knows who she is.
It's too hard to say the whole name, I guess.
Yeah. But even her, you know, her Twitter handle is AOC. So it's amazing. But, you know, she has her own voice and she's able to do that. I couldn't do the same thing, right? A lot of people couldn't do the same thing. So don't copy her because if you copy her, you know, you're going to look ridiculous. But there may be a way for you to kind of become more real, more, I hate the word, but authentic with your constituents, right? And she's definitely got a national platform. Most politicians don't, right? Most politicians have a local district platform, the average politician. And that's all that matters. And that's all that should matter, right? So how do they speak to their audience? So for example, my local state delegate in Virginia, Marcus Simon, right? He's Falls Church McLean, right? I mean, this is state politics in Virginia. He's, you know, 30 something, maybe early 40s, but he does a great job with, you know, Facebook Live, right? He's like, hey, here I am on the floor of the House in Richmond, and we're talking about a bill that I've been talking about, and I want, you know, here, so let's see what's going on. Or he, you know, goes into his office and says, here's a report from today and what happened in the House of Delegates. And that works for him, right? And it's a really great use of social media.
Most people, it's a lot of chopping wood. For a few people, suddenly you're a famous wood chopper.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's
right?
Kind of the nature of the age we live in.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, that's it. So I appreciate that this has been great. Great to meet you. Great to have you be on.
Well, nice to talk to you too. Anything else you want to say?
I think I would leave it from a political perspective. I am really, I'm so excited about the incredible candidates that we have. And I don't have any particular person that I'm looking for, but I'm totally going to support, you know, whoever comes out of those primaries. I 150% support them. And I encourage everybody else out there who's at all on the progressive side that, you know, let's not have kind of internal purity wars and tests and destroy each other before we have a chance, because there's a really good chance that Trump will win again, and we can't let that happen.
I am with you. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
That was Sean Dakin of Dakin & Associates. You can find him on Twitter as @DakinMarketing. Glad to have his expertise on our side of the fight. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman, The Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.